This is John Abrams, and this is The Variety Artist, episode 58. If you get a chance, either before or after you listen to this interview, make sure to watch some of Frank's hilarious routines on YouTube. I won't give everything away, but if you get a chance, watch his Johnny Carson appearance, the videos from Twisted Cabaret, and his tongue trick theater. You'll be glad you did. After watching his routines, you'll realize, like I did, that a lot of people have copied his style. There's lots of entertainers out there right now that do almost a carbon copy of Frank's well-rehearsed chaos. But there's only one funny Frank, folks. Enjoy the interview.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He shared the same bill with a young Dana Carvey, Robin Williams, and Whoopi Goldberg. He's known as one of the funniest jugglers on the planet and has his own one-man show, two-man show called Twisted Cabaret. Variety artist, I give you Frank Olivier.
Hey, hey. Good to be here.
How's it going, Frank?
Going well, John. How about for yourself?
Great. I'm glad to have you on.
Oh, glad to be here. Yeah.
In fact, I put on my Facebook that my Variety Artist Facebook family could ask you questions, and I have to read a couple of things that people said.
Absolutely.
Suzanne Herring, maybe you know Suzanne, known as Schmoozy, says, I love Frank Olivier.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chris Shepard, who also had a podcast called, I think it was Successful Performance Podcast, says, awesome sauce.
Oh, glad to hear it.
And Barry Friedman says, oh, that's going to be fun. Frank is a fantastic wild card.
We'll see about that.
That I just butter you up, you know, before the interview here.
So you found three people to say nice things about me.
That's right. I didn't even have to call them or anything.
No, excellent. Great. Okay. No, it should be fun.
So we're going to start from the beginning. So when did you know you wanted to be an entertainer?
I started juggling and unicycling at age 11, and it wasn't with any idea of performing. And I started doing magic at about age 12, actually wanting to be a performer, probably at age 15 when I saw A. Whitney Brown. I don't know if you know who that is. It was on Saturday Night Live for a bunch of years. He was actually the head writer of Saturday Night Live for a bunch of years. But when I first met him, he was a street juggler in San Francisco.
Okay.
Performing for the lines, waiting to get on the ferry boat in San Francisco. And there was this man with the skills I already had. I mean, I was already a better juggler than he was. And here he was talking to the crowd in a way which I had never seen before. Oh. I'd seen these sort of stagey, clowny shows where you could tell it was a routine. He wasn't talking with you. And mm-hmm. Here all of a sudden was this guy who was... The fourth wall was down, the crowd was part of the show, and it was interactive, and he was very, very funny, and he was making enough money to live on.
Oh, so you saw that and you went,
Ooh, all the arrows started pointing that direction from there on in.
And how old were you then? About?
15.
Wow. Now, yep. I was reading that at age 13, you had a regular spot on San Francisco TV.
There was a TV kids show called Get Box Tickle, put on by John Fromer and some folks over at KRON, the NBC affiliate in San Francisco.
What were you doing?
Everything. He had kids who were singers and guitar players on, and I also play guitar. My dad was a guitar teacher. Mm. And so I was playing guitar and juggling and unicycling, doing magic tricks, and being one of the cast members of this local kids TV show.
And that was at 13 years old?
Yes.
Wow.
And also there was a local circus that got started up around the same time, the Berkeley Circus, mm-hmm. which was a spinoff of another circus that had gone on a couple years earlier called Major Chumley's Amazing Traveling Circus and Combined Pandemonium Shadow Show. That was another big influence on me when I was a youth. He gets into Berkeley where they are setting up the tent and they're just planning on staying there. And no, you're not allowed to sleep in the public park. That would be against the rules. So he figures out a loophole and gets all 18 people put on as security guards, meaning they're allowed to spend the night in the park. He did all this and he was 18 years old.
Wow.
That was Chumley. Another big counterculture influence on me.
I've had a couple of people on this podcast that have been to Ringling Brothers Clown College, but none of them flunked out.
Oh, yeah.
Except for one. And who would that be?
What, me?
Oh!
I didn't really flunk out. At that point, I don't know what they were thinking, but they said you were only officially a graduate of Clown College if you were offered and accepted a diploma, a contract with Ringling Brothers.
Oh, okay.
And so I guess I flunked out because they didn't offer me a contract until several months later. And by that point, I'd already started doing street performing in San Francisco and was making way more money doing that than I would have doing 12 shows a week with Ringling.
So what are some of the secrets of street performing?
Street performing? Yeah. That's its whole own thing. At the time, it was the heyday of street performing. It was still that magical time when people came across a show. They thought, oh my goodness, this is delightful. Rather than, oh goodness, here's somebody trying to con us out of something.
Uh-huh.
It was a fantastic time to be getting into it. And you could do real character work with it at the time. Now it seems like everyone is primarily cheerleaders for their own shows. And it's harder to build a character show when you're busy doing that.
Well, let's talk about some of your shows. First, the thing you're probably most famous for, at least from what I've seen, your unicycle riding.
Oh, right.
Now, I know you're a friggin' great unicycle rider, yet you became famous looking like you didn't know what the heck you were doing.
Well-rehearsed chaos, that's my specialty.
I mean, you know, I've seen other unicycle riders, and they're like, look at me, I'm riding a unicycle, look how awesome this is, where you took the opposite approach.
Well, my whole show was always fairly clumsy, it was a juggling show on the verge of falling apart. A lot of people, once they get up on a tall unicycle, look like they can't ride. But a huge number of the guys who do that have this slick, perfect act. And then you're supposed to believe all of a sudden they get on the unicycle and they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
My whole show looked like I didn't know what I was doing. So it fit what I was doing a little bit better.
So when did you decide, well, you're unicycle riding and juggling and you're doing all these different things, and then you combine them?
I started doing the juggling came first, and then I don't know, you see the pictures of the clowns or people riding a unicycle, you figure that's something you could do with your legs, you can do something else with your hands. There was really no other jugglers around when I was learning. In fact, when I learned juggling, it was on my own, and I learned three balls in a shower over a period of a couple of years of working on it before somebody said, why are you doing it that way? Why don't you do it the easy way, up the middle, the cascade?
Uh-huh.
Boom, mind blown. Oh my goodness, you could do all these tricks all of a sudden, and it wasn't nearly as hard. Yeah, and when we got, me and my juggling partner, when we were 16, we had unicycles, but we wanted to get tall unicycles, and they weren't available anywhere for sale at the time. Schwinn hadn't even started making them at that point. And so we had to wait until we got into metal shop when we were 16, when we could weld up our own frames, and that was when I started doing the tall unicycling.
So you made your own unicycle?
Oh, I had to. Yeah, there wasn't one as available.
I was looking at your videos, and one of my favorite, and I'm sure you've heard this a million times, is the Johnny Carson one.
That was magic.
Yeah, I'm a huge Johnny Carson fan. So that was magic. Now, how did your life change from before Johnny Carson to after Johnny Carson?
Oh, I got about 2 to 3 times the work at about over twice as much money per show.
Oh, yeah.
Doubled my price overnight and had a huge amount more work all of a sudden coming through, and photo shoot in Vogue magazine and just everything.
Would you say that's the thing that changed your career trajectory?
Probably the thing that changed it the most was a couple of years before that. I'd been doing street performing in San Francisco, saved up enough money I wanted to go back east, see what New York was like. So I was going on vacation to New York. Just planned as a vacation. I didn't even bring along a unicycle or anything. Got out to the East Coast, was staying with Tony Duncan and a guy named Steve, who was a ventriloquist, a Danish ventriloquist guy. Anyways, stayed with them in this huge loft at Houston and Broadway. Amazing space. I'd never seen loft living. After that, I lived in a loft for many, many years. Mind blown. You could rehearse and live in the same space. And anyways, I was going to stay there for 2 weeks. Phone answering machines had just come in, where the kind of phone answering machine where you could pick up the messages from away from home. And I'd just gotten one. You'd play this little beeper thing into your phone and you could pick up your messages.
Yeah, it was high tech at the time.
It was very high tech, and I was picking up messages, and there was somebody trying to reach me to get me into a show up in Vancouver. But I was sending them messages, they were sending me messages, and when we finally reached each other, we were both in New York. It was the producers of Sugar Babies wanting to know if I could come up to Vancouver to audition, and when we put it together, we were both in New York. They said, well, we could do an audition here then. I said, fantastic. They said, we've got a theater available tomorrow afternoon. Come over and do an audition for us. And I was a street performer. And I'd worked comedy clubs and stuff, but I hadn't ever played for just to do an audition with no crowd. They go, yeah, an empty theater.
Yeah. So you're in an empty theater, no crowd, no props.
That scared the piss out of me. I could borrow Tony's unicycle. I knew that. And I had a few other props along. And so I asked them if I could find a place to actually perform in front of a crowd tomorrow night rather than tomorrow afternoon. Could we do it then? They said, well, yes, but how would you do that? I said, let me work on it. Mm-hmm. I open up the Village Voice newspaper. I'm looking for a comedy setting. And in there is Jim Samuels doing an early show, like a 7 o'clock show or something. He was somebody I knew from the San Francisco comedy scene. He'd won the comedy competitions the year I was in it and was a good buddy of mine. And there he was, Jim Samuels, playing in a comedy club at 7 p.m., a few blocks from where I was. And I go and watch his set. And then I say, Jim, where could I perform around here? That wasn't the right space at all.
Yeah.
He says, come on, I'll show you around to a few of the clubs. And we walk in. So the third club we came into was the Comic Strip on 2nd Avenue. And this was the place. I could just feel it. I'd say, oh, my God, if I could. I asked somebody, who books the room? They go, oh, that'd be Lucian Hold, that gentleman over there. And I got told dozens of times since then that what I then did was impossible. Uh-huh. Huge number of comics. I walked up to Lucian Hold on a Friday night, telling him, I want to go on first show on Saturday. Yeah. Here I am, an unknown. I've got these producers that are interested in me for a big show, and I've looked at a number of rooms, and this is where I want to do it. And he was a little suspicious, but he ended up going along with it.
Oh.
I found out later, yeah, from all these comics, no, people wait for months to get on a Tuesday at 1 a.m. That's the way you get on at the Comic Strip. But I waltzed in on a Friday night, talked my way onto a Saturday night show. The producers came out and saw me and loved me and booked me into that show, Sugar Babies. I toured with that show for 3 years.
What a series of events.
It was fantastic. And the magic of this trip just kept going. So now I did the audition, kicked it, just had a fabulous show. And was always welcome back at the Comic Strip as long as Lucian was there, mm-hmm. until he passed away. Now I don't know if anyone there knows me anymore, but I used to go in and do guest spots there anytime I'd want. When do you want to go on? But then Michael Davis gets on the phone with me and tells me the producers loved you. They want to hire you for this. It was just for 2 weeks while he was out initially. Mm-hmm. It was just filling in for 2 weeks for Michael Davis. And he said, they want to hire you, and how much are you going to ask them for? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a street performer, and I've been doing comedy clubs for no money. And I said, I don't know, $1,000 a week.
Okay.
And he says, twice that. I said, twice that. He goes, yes. And don't settle for anything less.
Yeah.
Well, now it's not a couple hours after that, I'm in the producer's office. They say, we love you. We want you to play in this big show with Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller. And you're going to, and we fly you up to Seattle, I mean, up to Toronto, rather. They had the tickets for me and everything. And here's the contract, and it pays $1,250 a week. And Michael Davis had just told me $2,000 a week, and don't settle for anything less. Uh-huh. So I swallow real hard. This looks like an awful good thing to be turning. I swallow real hard and say, if I'm going to come in and do this, I'm going to need to get $2,000 a week.
You never made that in your life, right?
Nowhere close to it. And they go in the back and they talk and they talk and they come out and say, okay, $2,000 a week. And we'll have a new contract for you up there when you arrive. Now I fly up to Toronto. I meet these old comics. This was Sugar Babies was done in the style of an old burlesque show.
Yep.
And they had some of the real old timers there, including this guy, Mickey Deems, an old radio comedian and who'd done burlesque and like that. And Mickey and I hit it off right away. I mean, I just met the guy and could tell we were going to be good friends. Okay, how much you getting, kid? I'm making $2,000 a week.
Yeah.
He says, including or not including per diem? What's per diem?
You're like, I don't know.
I don't know these things. He says, look, I'm the union rep. This is an AGVA show, American Guild of Variety Artists.
Right.
I'm the union rep, and there's $2,000 a week could either include or not include the $495 minimum that you get for your living expenses for the week.
Dang, you're just going ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Well, no, this is what, now I walk into the company manager's office. He goes, here's the contract. Here's how it breaks down. It's $1,505 a week salary.
Oh, there you go.
$495 a week per diem, $2,000. I said, we negotiated a $2,000 salary. There's a union minimum on the per diem, isn't there?
And
now he's off calling up the producers and they're talking back and forth and boom. I'm up to $2,500 a week.
You're just rolling around in it.
And I had, and the thing was, I was flying by the seat of my pants completely. I would have accepted their contract off the bat if it had been on my own, but I'm getting all the information I need moments before I need it. And that was a magical time.
Oh, that's terrific.
I ended up doing the show for 3 years, touring with Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller. And getting reviews from across the country. That made a huge difference in my career.
Wow. So you're making money, you're collecting reviews, you're meeting all sorts of famous people.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Boy, that would change your career, huh?
It did. And I learned how to play a 2,000-seat room. The first couple shows I did up in Toronto, everyone was saying, oh, you're doing so well. It's so good to have you here. And I was like fuming. I was not getting the crowd. I wasn't getting the timing to play. It's a different timing to play for 2,000 people than to play for 150 people.
It's true.
And I was not getting it. And I was reworking things and trying to shift it around. Managed to figure it out after a couple of days, and then I started killing and having fun with it. And from there on, it was a blast.
Oh man, do you see? I know the adjustments that I make when it's a larger crowd. What adjustments do you make between the smaller 150 people and 2,000?
Depending on the room, sometimes you need to actually speak a little bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different pacing than a comedy club or a street show where you're just talking and it can be a little bit faster and quicker and snappier. And there, you needed to present idea, and find your punches. You need to clean it up a huge amount. Well, I guess I'd learned some of that from the comedy club. When you're working at a 10-minute spot on a comedy club stage, you don't have a lot of street performers use that opening 10 minutes of crowd gathering to get to know the crowd and to introduce themselves to the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this slow motion thing that happens where they get to know you over a period of time. When you're performing on a stage, you're on stage, and that's the time you get. Walking on stage is the time you get for them to either feel comfortable with what you're offering or to decide they don't like you.
Now, I was watching your videos, and it was funny watching the Johnny Carson video from the 70s. I guess it was the 70s, right?
No, that was actually 80. I think that was 86 or 87. Yeah, it was.
Oh, so late 80s. Interesting.
Yeah.
And then after I watched that, I saw the AGT video with Howie Mandel, and it's almost the same.
The same friggin' routine. I've been doing these jokes since I was a little kid.
Hey, if it works, it works.
It works. I come up with enough new routines and keep myself interested in different ways and constantly working on new props and new ideas and still love it. I know there's people that get burned out on this business. I'm not one of them.
Yeah, you and me both. I love doing it. You know, I love performing. In fact, as long as we're talking about different things that you do, I like to talk to people about different things that they're not necessarily famous for. And one of the things I read on your website is that you do spoof speaker presentations. Now, I'd never heard this before. So tell me about that.
I've done a bunch of those. Get brought in as a lawyer or as a somebody telling them about business practices or something, and it starts off, they give you five or six talking points of things that'll make you sound like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You interview them and ask for these things. And then from there, I usually end up throwing in a juggling analogy, a second juggling analogy, and then I pull out balls, labeling the balls as, you know, this would be the, you give an analogy. It's a lot like juggling. And then you end up doing the juggling and then people start screaming because you're juggling three balls. And then you say, but then you haven't thought about one more element and five balls. And at a certain point, it breaks down and becomes a comedy act and has nothing to do with the speaking at all, much to the delight of the crowd. The most fun ones are the where the talk is on a topic so boring.
Yeah.
Talking about price fixing and how the government's cracking down on smaller businesses now on the price fixing that we're all doing and what we're going to do around these laws. And I come out with a big stack of papers and we got a lot to get through here. So let's get started. And you can see the eyes glaze over, and then you got all the props hidden in the podium you're talking from and start pulling stuff out. And then unicycles from the back at the end and all that. Yeah. It's good fun.
Oh, they're loving that. Uh-huh. They're ready for a big boring talk, and all of a sudden it turns into this. Turns into you.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Well, tell me about your Twisted Cabaret.
Twisted Cabaret started 17 years ago. I just had all these weird ideas for routines that I could never actually use almost anywhere I was performing, you know, doing corporate shows or cruise ships or all these different things. The idea was to take all these weirdest ideas I had and put them all into one show. Since then, it's got a little more mainstream, but at the time, it was pretty out there.
It's pretty outrageous now. Where do you do those?
At Twisted Cabaret, we just finished doing a month-long run of shows up in Seattle.
In a theater or?
In a theater, yeah.
And do you also travel around doing those for private events?
I've done, occasionally Twisted Cabaret gets hired. It's kind of a heavy show to travel with, and I do it with Paul Nathan, who's an amazing comedian and magician in his own right. But when he's working with me, he ends up doing no magic at all. He's just got to do character work. And he's become a very, very funny clown character over the period of time I've worked with him.
He's hilarious. He's the hunchback master of ceremonies, right?
Well, we switched it. This last year, he didn't want to do the hunchback thing anymore because his back was hurting from hunching that way.
Well, one of my favorite things in Twisted Cabaret, I was watching all your videos. Yeah. I was stalking you. Okay. You know, I admit it.
Okay. All right.
And I'm not sure if this is weird and creepy telling you this, but the routine that you do with tongue tricks.
The tongue trick theater. Yes.
Is that what it's called?
That was the routine I thought when I first wrote the routine, came up with the idea of it. I could do four or five tricks with my tongue. And I thought, okay, this will be a 30 seconds to 1 minute on stage. No, it's a 3 minute routine, 4 minute routine. It's one of my favorite things right now in the show.
And the audience is going crazy, huh?
Well, what's so much fun about it is we put it up on a big screen. So you got your face, just your face up on the full size of the stage, as big as you can get it.
Yeah.
Projected up with a camera. And you get to do these smallest little motions with the...
It's
like flirty motions with my lip twitching a little bit and the crowd roaring. And when you get to that point where you get the smallest, the littlest twitches of your face with the whole crowd screaming. And there's the tricks where I turn my tongue all the way over and make a wave roll down my tongue and curl my tongue into three different loops and a bunch of different actual tricks with it. Blowing bubbles off the end of my tongue.
Yeah.
I think it's probably half the people listening can do.
Yeah, but they didn't have the smarts to put it into a routine.
Yeah, tongue trick theater, the preeminent venue for lingual artists of our time. This is Paul. So Paul talks that entire routine. I do that one silent myself.
And after you do that routine, I know this may be a personal question. Have you had anybody come up to you and said, oh, Frank, your tongue,
All the time. It's a pain in the rear.
Oh, is it a pain?
No, it's just that's one of the jokes. You always get groups of ladies wanting to talk about that.
Oh, your tongue tricks are a pain in the rear. What a strange.
No.
I never thought that would be on this podcast.
No.
Well, before we go on to some fan questions and a game and everything, one last question for you. I noticed that on your website, instead of billing yourself as, you know, juggler, unicycle rider, it says book comedian Frank Olivier for your next event today. It's comedian.
Comedian. Well, I'm selling comedy and I'm selling myself. And juggling right now, if you haven't noticed, isn't real hot. Mm-hmm. Magic right now is very hot.
Yeah.
A huge number of magicians out there working, and that's not a bad thing to be. Juggler right now is, I don't know why. It'll change around. Things switch around. There's different ebbs and flows to all of these things. But right now, it doesn't seem to be the hot thing, so I'm not selling myself as a... that's not the primary thing I'm doing. The primary thing I'm doing is... I have crowds there laughing and having a good time and involved in these outrageous routines.
I think it seems like AGT is making a huge difference in what's popular and what's not. Like for a while back, ventriloquism was never hot until Terry Fader won AGT and suddenly it's hot, right?
Yep.
And then Shin Lim recently won.
No, there was also Jeff Dunham.
Oh, that's right.
I toured with Jeff Dunham for a short bit. He was in the Sugar Babies towards the end of my run. Mm. He was a top paid comedian in the world for a chunk of time there, Jeff.
Right.
Well, what he did that was super smart, when he got his Comedy Central special, he was the producer on it, and he got the right to all the footage, and nobody realized it at the time. He's been a sharp, sharp guy all along, building up mailing lists back from when it was all done on paper or, you know, early on, building up his mailing lists in all the different cities. So he went from working comedy clubs to four-walling places because he had built up these mailing lists. And then the smart thing he did there was, when he got the Comedy Central thing, he kept the rights to it, and he put up all the clips of the different puppet things he was doing.
Ah.
And Ahmed the Dead Terrorist was one of the early things to go super viral. And all of a sudden, Jeff Dunham's a star making zillions of dollars, and that's all through his own hard work and cleverness and being a sharp business guy.
Wow, so a good businessman and a good act.
Yep. Oh yeah, yeah.
All right, we're gonna move on to fact or something John just made up. Sound like fun?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it fact or is it something John just made up?
I'm going to read a headline. You're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little more about it.
Okay.
Here we go. First headline. During a show, Frank once scared a man so badly that his false teeth flew out of his mouth.
That was true.
Oh, it's true. What happened there?
I was doing a street show years ago in Europe. I think it was in Frankfurt, on this walking street.
Wait, ironically, Frankfurt.
Yeah, exactly. Doing a street show on the street. I was gathering up a crowd, already a big crowd of people there laughing, but I didn't quite have an edge yet. And a guy comes through on his bicycle, ding, 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 and riding and weaving through the middle of the crowd. And I wait till he gets right up next to me. I say, "What the hell are you doing?" And it scared him, and he dropped something. He came back around and picked it up. It was his teeth that came out of his mouth. It was one of those laughs when people realize what it was, saw him put his teeth back in and ride his bicycle off. One of those laughs that went on so long.
You just stood there and waited. Just wait.
You don't need to do anything at that point.
It's hilarious. That's an extra tip day.
Exactly. Finally gave a capper of, "He won't ride through my show again."
All right. Next one. Frank had Bill Murray in a tutu on his shoulders and didn't know how to get him off.
That would also be true. That was a wild time at San Francisco Golf Club, a super conservative club. They'd never had any entertainment there. I said, "Any entertainment?" "Oh, no, no. Once we had a guitarist play a little music during dinner. But aside from that, this was the first entertainment they'd had. And this guy from Morgan Stanley brought me in. And it was some sort of golf invitational thing going on. And I'm doing walk around magic beforehand. There's Bill Murray. So I go up to Gordon, the guy that booked me. He said, "Gordon, Bill Murray's here." He says, "Yeah." I said, "I want to invite him to come up and be one of my volunteers." He says, "Absolutely not." Mm-hmm. Mr. Murray is our guest, and I don't want you asking him to perform. That's how it starts. You already know how it ends.
Yeah, it's the perfect invitation.
And I gave the right response. I said, well, he's also an old comedy guy, and I'm doing a comedy show and bringing up volunteers, and to not invite him might be wrong.
Yeah.
He says, oh, okay, you might be right. Okay, you can invite him, but no pressure.
Uh-oh.
He's worked with me a bunch. He knows how I can get people to do things they don't want to do.
Yeah.
I say, okay, well, I'll take that. You know, it just went from absolutely not to I can ask the guy. Mr. Murray, I've been doing card tricks for him a few minutes earlier. I'm a huge fan. I'm doing a comedy show after dinner, and I use a couple of volunteers. If you'd like to be one of those people, I'd be honored. He says, usually I like to try and steer away from that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told no pressure, so I said, absolutely fine, no problem.
Yep.
But I shot such a lousy game of golf today, I deserve it. Yeah, bring me up. Rake me over the coals. This is going to be fun.
All right.
You know how he ramps up his energy in the movies?
Yeah.
He does that in person, too. Right before when I was getting the show set up, Gordon, the guy who had hired me, says, I see you doing the setting up for the unicycle ballet, the tutu number. And he says, I'm not going to tell you what to do or not do, but this is a pretty conservative crowd. I would probably lean away from that one. I said, okay.
You're like, another perfect invitation. Yay.
So I said, okay. I took the note. He didn't want to tell me what to do or not do, but he would personally lean away from that one. I said, that's fine. I went over and told the sound person, we might not do these cues at all. Don't worry about it if we don't. I said, okay, great. And now I get on stage and I start doing my act. And from the back of the club on the chin balancing trick or whatever it was. And from the back of the room, I hear, don't do it. Hmm? And I realized right away what's happening. He's an old Second City guy.
Yeah.
So it's an improv rule. One of the things you never do in improv is considered very rude to bring a player into a scene without, you know, for you to bring them into the scene is the wrong way for it. They have to bring themselves in.
Okay.
So that's exactly what he's doing. He's bringing himself into the show following the rules of improv.
Yep.
So I'm juggling three clubs, about to do this trick, and I hear, you know, the club on the chin balancing trick. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Just stop juggling. Hang my arms at my side. And he's all the way in the back of the room. I say, Mr. Bill Murray heckling me. Usually I try to discourage hecklers, but this is an honor, Mr. Murray. You go right ahead. And he does. He keeps yelling stuff out through the show, throughout my act. And about the third or fourth time he yells something out, I say, okay, the unicycle ballet is in. And after I do the unicycle ballet, I'm bringing Bill Murray up and we're going to dance in tutus. I get a volunteer into a tutu. And that's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly what. One more time, he cued the entire table to yell out what at one point, "Don't do it!" to one of my tricks.
Yeah.
And then I finished up the unicycle ballet. I'm walking all the way through the long distance of this long thin room down to the far end and saying, "Now the true heart of the ballet isn't in the solo like what I've just done. The true heart of the ballet is rather in the pas de deux, and our eyes lock." And I hold my hands out to him, and he lifts his hands up to me, and I walk him all the way down the length of the room and out into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I've got a new clever way of getting someone into a tutu now, but at the time I climbed him into it, got him into a tutu. This is, I don't know what, probably 12 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, got him into a tutu, and when we came out, the room lost it. Both of us in tutus, and doing this dance routine. I get somebody doing a bunch of different stuff. He's doing half of it, and he's also doing his own routine for half of it. It doesn't matter. It's Bill Murray.
It's Bill Murray.
He's killing it. But I usually get somebody on my back, and then I hike them up until they're actually sitting on my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Did that with Bill Murray. He's a big man. He's probably 220 at the time.
Okay.
And I've got him sitting on my shoulders, and all of a sudden, I realize I can't move to the right, and I can't move to the left. I'm stuck where I am. And I realize he's holding on to the cast iron chandelier over our heads.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm stuck, and I'm starting to feel weak. My knees are getting weak, and I'm saying, Mr. Murray, I know it seems funny, but let go of the chandelier. I can hear him laughing and the crowd laughing. Found out later he was trying to change one of the bulbs in it.
Oh!
And then I'm seriously stuck trying to figure out. That was where I was saying I didn't know how to get him down.
Yeah.
And then I realized, wait, if I bend my knees and lower myself down, he either needs to stay with the chandelier or come with me.
Right.
And he came with me and finished up the routine. We're running out of music. I never run out of music on that. There's way more recorded than I need, but the routine's gone long because he's all over the place. And I normally get somebody facing towards me, holding my hands and standing on my thighs and leaning away. But we're going to be doing this after the music is over. I'm thinking, am I still going to do this? I thought, oh, what the heck? Yeah. All I did was tap my legs and he knew right away where I was going to. And he jumps up, hits the last note of the music, one arm out, big flourish, jumps down, instant standing ovation from the entire crowd. That was definitely a career highlight.
Oh man, I wish I had that on tape. I wish I could see that.
I wish I had a single picture. There was nothing, nothing.
Well, now you have this story.
I do. And then every once in a while, I run into one of the couple hundred people that were in the room and they always say, that thing with Bill Murray. And I get to relive it.
That's great. In fact, you know what? I'm not even going to go on and ask you anymore because that was such a great story that I don't think we can top that.
That was Fact or Something John Just Made Up.
Would you like some fan questions?
Absolutely.
All right. I'm going to start off with an easy one, and then we're going to get a little more fun. All right. Eddie Rice Jr., owner and performer of A1 Best Events and Entertainment, asks, have you ever fallen off your unicycle?
Fallen off? I've had to get off a number of times. Actually fallen. I've had two bad falls. One was where I was doing an outdoor show for Edinburgh. For the Edmonton Street Performers Festival. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a bit where I would ride through the crowd over to a tree and grab onto a tree. And this is not a pleasant one. Doesn't have a happy, it wasn't a terrible thing, but it was bad at the time. I'm riding, and I split the crowd, I get the whole crowd moving out of the way, and I'm riding towards this tree, and a little, probably 4-year-old girl doesn't like what she's seeing and steps right in front of me and says, no.
Oh, no.
No. Just holding up her hands like, no, don't do this.
No.
So I have to take a quick turn. And this is on lawn. And you monitor pretty carefully where you're riding. But I didn't have time to monitor. I took a sharp turn and had to come down off the unicycle. And the unicycle went and bumped a small child's head as I was coming. A different child's head. And this little boy's head started bleeding. And that was one of my nightmares.
Oh no.
Another one that was, and then the other nightmare was filming for a show called, what was it called? Comedy on the Road with John Biner. Mm-hmm. They were being super cheap about it, but it was TV. So you say yes and you say yes to everything, but then they didn't want to pay the, whatever it was, $80 to fly my unicycle up. Because at the time I wasn't fitting them into a normal suitcase. At the time it was a separate duffel bag. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to pay the extra money to fly my cycle up there. So they said they had one lined up for me. Don't ever do that.
You don't know what you're getting into.
They'd lined up a tall unicycle for me. I get up there. It's not a tall unicycle. It's a short unicycle. Now, at the time, I used to travel with the juggler's roster, the IJA juggler's roster, for this exact sort of situation. So I'm on the phone now calling up everyone in the area looking for a tall unicycle. And I locate a tall unicycle, and it's a guy who lives an hour out of town, but for tickets to the show, he'll come in, he'll bring his tall unicycle. Mm-hmm. It shows up there an hour before showtime or something, and there's no air in the tire.
Oh, no.
Now I'm out on the streets of Gastown, is the area of Vancouver where I am, and there's no gas stations in Gastown. And I'm trying to figure out how to get the air in this tire.
wait, back up. There's no gas stations in Gastown?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I'm flagging down bicyclists, and I finally find somebody with the right type of pump, and I pump up the tire, and I go in, and I'm literally on stage within moments after getting inside. But this thing had a lock ring on the bottom of it. Instead of being bolted properly, it was an old style of unicycle. They used to use a lock ring. And while I'm on stage, on this borrowed 6-foot unicycle.
No.
With a 5-foot deep, I'm on the front part of the stage, which is 5-foot deep, 6-foot tall unicycle. The pedals slip. just the pedals move separate from the wheel. The pedals slip and the wheel goes back and hits the back edge of that lip, of the 5 foot lip. And I'm on a 6 foot unicycle and there's no way you're going but down. Yeah. And I'm falling forward and I'm falling off the front edge of the stage and do a belly flop onto this table between this couple there, shattering a glass there. And I jump up and I shake each of their hands vigorously saying, thank you. I've been watching you two through the entire show and you've been an incredible moral support. Thank you so much for being here. And I jump back up on the unicycle. Now I'm not going to ride it at all. I'm not going to backpedal it at all because I'm only going to ride it forward. And I end up riding it forward and finishing the show very, very gingerly on the unicycle, finishing it up.
So when you fell, you were just like, ta-da, wasn't that amazing?
A belly flop onto a table, exactly. Afterwards, the producers were saying, that was hilarious, but you should have told us you were going to do that. I said, told you. That wasn't hilarious. That was scary. They go, no, they weren't believing me until I opened up my shirt and I showed them, no, I did a belly flop onto that table. I broke a glass. They said, yeah. And I opened up my shirt and there's this cut on my belly.
Ow.
And that was one of the biggest, scariest falls ever. And they said they were going to put that on TV. And I said, you'd do me a big favor if you'd edit that out. They go, why? I said, because nobody wants to hire an act that's falling off the stage.
Or the opposite. Everybody will want that.
I don't think so. I think that it looked too friggin' dangerous.
Dang.
Anyway.
All right, we're going to go to the next fan question.
Yeah.
Rob Balchunas, known as Rob the Balloon Guy, asks, he might know you because I don't even know what some of these questions mean. Have you ever performed a card trick or card tricks in a car before?
In a car? Oh, yes. There's some YouTube footage of me on, not just in a car. I was joking. I was coming back from Los Angeles with my friend Jordan Goldklang, Jordan Gold, and I'm driving and we're on the I-5. And I start telling him about how I'd done a couple tricks in a car before. And he said, really? And so I start doing card tricks. I'm rolling down the window and pulling up next to another car and yelling across, name any card in the deck. Yell out the name of any card. And they yell out the name of, I got a couple people to actually do it. And he's filming it on his phone. They yell out the name of a card. And I toss the cards in the air while driving with my knees. And grab one card out with my mouth, and I did that a couple times, and then a couple other tricks while driving. But that was the one.
Is that on YouTube right now?
I think if you do a search for it, you can find it. If not, we can get the link up.
We're going to go to our last one, and this is an interesting one too. Lily von Stupp, one of the top. Oh. Do you know Lily?
Yeah, I know Lily.
Okay, one of the top burlesque performers in the country asks, how many photos of feet are in your wallet?
that's a routine I haven't done in a little while. And I think maybe with the Me Too, maybe it's days or past.
Oh, uh-oh.
A card trick where I get a woman on stage sitting down and naming any card in the deck. And you know, she says, six of diamonds, whatever. I take this giant deck of cards and I tap her foot with it. And I say, you're not going to believe this, but take off your shoe. And I get her to take off her shoe. And if she has a stocking, you know, a sock, take off the sock too. Now hold your foot up. And I take out my phone and I start taking pictures of her foot from all these different angles.
Oh, no.
And then let me wrap my hand around it. Okay, now let me get one with my face in there. Get one with, you know, and kissing her feet and whatever I can get away with. As long as she's laughing and having a good time, I keep going. And at the end of that, I say, okay, let's get back to the magic.
So the whole routine isn't really even picking the card. The whole routine is her feet.
Taking pictures of her foot in this kind of sleazy way and say, you don't think they let some creep actually come out and take pictures of patrons' feet. You don't think they'd actually do that. And then as I'm doing this, I accidentally drop a fan fold of 15 foot pictures. Oh.
Oh, out of your wallet?
Out of my wallet, exactly. There's a whole... Anyway, it goes on and on, but it's a stupid bit. It ends up with the big deck of cards being put down into my pants and one card rising out of my pants.
Oh, perfect.
And that is the card she's asked for. And when I can, I get her to pull it out with her teeth. And it's fun, but its days may be gone.
Yeah. It's a routine you can't do nowadays. Gosh dang it.
I don't know. Gotta ask more. Gotta do more asking of permission.
Yeah.
And be ready to bail if the answer is no.
Right. If someone wants to get a hold of you through social media or whatever, what do you have?
What do I have? I've got nothing right now. I've got just been taking care of some family stuff with my father.
Well, should I put the link for Twisted Cabaret on your show notes?
Twisted Cabaret, funnyfrank.com. Yeah. Actually, I got a new theater show I've just put together. It's also a keynote address. The website doesn't look great yet, but it's up there. Tricks to Happiness.
Okay. .com?
.com, yeah.
Okay. Tricks to Happiness. I'll put all those on your show notes if you don't mind.
Well, you got time for another minute or two?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Just you'd ask about tips for new performers.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We have a couple different types of people listening to this. Some are tips for new. I mean, some are just starting to perform, and some are working pros. So, yeah, do you have some tips for some people just starting out or some pros?
Yeah. Well, any which way. The most important thing for newcomers to know is that the first 100 shows don't count.
Ah.
That's my biggest piece of advice. That means go out there, try different stuff, and work it different ways. And if you want to get better, you do lots of shows. And if you really want to get better, you audio record every show you do, and you listen through it on your way home from the gig. And if there's anything there at all, you jot down any improvisations you do. If you're at all like I am, you come up with jokes on stage under the pressure of the thing, and then you forget them rapidly, except the few here and there. But if you record the shows, record every show and listen through it on the way home.
And then you remember those jokes and do them next time.
Exactly. And you think, well, that couldn't happen because that only happened because of this specific situation. But you'd be surprised how many times you can create something that happens over and over again.
Do you have some advice for the working pro?
What pops to mind is one of the old timers told me about his advice was how to pack light on the road. It was about wearing a pair of boxer shorts for 4 days. You could do it because you could wear it frontwards, and then you could wear it backwards, and then you could turn it inside out. I do not recommend that.
I don't know. I like that advice. Well, thanks, Frank, for doing my show. This was awesome.
Oh, a pleasure. Anytime.
Great stories, wonderful things, great information. I loved having you on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. And a special thanks to all my listeners. Make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. And if you have 2 minutes, leave a nice review. Both Frank and I will appreciate it. I'll read them every few weeks and give you a shout out on the air here. If you found this podcast valuable, share it with your friends or on your social media. You can reach me at john@thevarietyartist.com or you can join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests like my new friend Frank. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
Woohoo!
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.